Mighty Van Pham lost her family's home when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. She and her husband had come to the U.S. as refugees from Vietnam. They made a good living on their own shrimp boat out of the small port of Pas Christian. But the hurricane took both their home and their boat. They were living in a FEMA trailer, and they couldn't get back on their feet. Like many in the Vietnamese community, they didn't take advantage of volunteer aid. But Mighty remembers meeting one woman who offered help rebuilding. Mighty had those details on a piece of paper.
I remember bringing the paper to my husband about the possibility that somebody is out there can help us build a house with a little bit of our money. And he would look at me and he said, "Why do you dream during the daytime? There's nothing free in America."
But Mighty trusted her instinct. She reached out for help, and now the Van Pham's have their new home. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The small Mississippi port town of Pas Christian was one of the hardest hit by Katrina. Since that time, the effort to get people's homes rebuilt has attracted considerable attention by the news media, including NPR News.
Some of these oak trees were here when Christopher Columbus landed.
Today, we continue our look at the Mississippi Gulf Coast and how Hurricane Katrina is reshaping the economy there.
You know, you can take a deep breath now and smell magnolias or jasmine or salt air.
Amy Hardy is a minister and a teacher from North Carolina. She's one of the people who went there to volunteer, and she's still there helping people rebuild. She met the Vietnamese woman, Mai Thi, almost a year after the hurricane.
And that was a crazy time. Pas Christian was very much like a frontier town. There were volunteers walking around. People weren't really following road traffic. It was a real wild and woolly time.
Mai Thi was out walking that day. She'd lived for a year in tents and trailers, and that's when she first saw the volunteers' trailer with the offer of help painted on the side.
And as I was walking, I remember around noontime, walking on the street of my neighborhood, I saw Miss Amy walking out from a building that said, "Helping people to rebuild house." And when I saw her, I told her about my story.
We were going out to scout some houses, and she walked up, and Vietnamese people had not traditionally come into the main fold of what we were doing. So when she kind of stood there shy over to the side, we were getting into the car, and we got out of the car and walked back over and said, "What can we do to help you?" And she just started crying and saying, "I have three children. No one will help me. I don't know what we're going to do. I have money. I have money." Magic words to us, not enough money. But she said, "I need to put my family back together." And we couldn't understand what she was saying because she has broken English. So we just all stood there and cried and patted each other on the shoulder and said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And we decided at that point we needed to make sure that she got a house.
I want to back up here a bit and have Mai Thi explain how it is she and her family got into such difficulty. She told me that they barely made it through the storm. In fact, when they heard that Katrina was coming, her children were at home. Mai Thi and her husband Long were out on the Gulf in the shrimp boat.
Lúc bão là hai vợ chồng tôi ở trên tàu tôm đi biển thì bao nhiêu lần bão thì không bao giờ có.
We were on the boat when the storm came. 2 weeks prior to that, there was another storm, and we did move our children, and the storm didn't hit as hard, so we didn't think much about this storm, so we were out on the sea. And after 3 days on the ocean, the children were at home, and we received a call from our relatives telling us that we need to move the boat to safer ground, and we need to come home to move our children. And I called my children on the telephone, and I was able to talk to them and tell them to get ready to go along with the relative. But I and my husband did not think much about the storm, because all these years that we have been here, we never really have a really bad storm, so we would just go on with the shrimping business. And then when the storm came, the water rise so high that I feel like the boat almost touched the cloud.
And did you have a lot of shrimp on board? Was the boat low in the water?
When we set out the ocean, we had to buy a lot of rocks and oil and supplies, so the boat was fairly stable. And after 3 days shrimping, we almost caught like about 5,000 pounds of shrimp. So it was fairly stable as far as the level of the boat in the water.
How far from shore were you?
Before the storm came, we were anchoring near the beach. But then when the storm actually hit, we were right in the middle of the ocean because I could not see land, I could not see trees, I could not see anything but water.
What did it sound like, Maya? What's the sound of a hurricane like when you're on a shrimp boat and you're miles from shore?
I remember hearing sound like metal, hitting metal, and it feel like these metal bar hitting the boat. And the boat tilted to one side, and then I had to run to the other side to try to balance the boat, but my weight is light, so it doesn't really do any good. And if you see the movie Titanic, when the ship sank, how the boat tilted and then people run to the other side, it's like that. And I never see so much winds and waters so violently hitting the boat in my life before.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Hurricane Katrina crashed down upon the boat, Mai Thi and her husband were fighting to stay afloat. But she says she was even more worried about her three children on land, one elder daughter, two sons at home.
I remember the feeling that I surely is going to die because all around me is water. But at the same time, I remember I don't want to die because I want to go back to my children. And I tried to call home to my children, but the phone was disconnected. And as I remember now, the worry that you have whether your children are alive or dead, it can almost kill you.
Were you blown to land? What happened?
The boat was blown onto the shore, and half of the boat landed on a train, and then half of it landed on a broken tree, but the boat didn't break in half. I remember seeing dead body floating by our boat, and I remember my husband had to tie a string up to the boat for me to hold on to and climb down. So it was fairly high up.
The boat was half on a train and half on a tree.
Yeah, half of it was on the box on a train.
Boxcars, yeah.
Right. And half of the boat was on it, and they had a half was hang on to a broken tree.
And so you had to get down with a rope. It was that high off,
right.
off the ground. How long were you on the boat? I mean, did you get down right after the storm, or was this days later?
We stay on the boat for about 3 days. We have some leftover sugar and some cookies. And so we stayed up there for 3 days, and then we were so thirsty. We didn't have anything to drink, so we climbed down. I remember we walked for almost about a mile to try to find water. It was hard to imagine with all that rain, all that storm that pulled down, yet after 3 days, the ground almost can be burned if there is a fire. It was that dry. And so we walk, and then we saw some pulled up water on the road. And we actually had to take our hand and scoop up some water. And I remember seeing those young mosquitoes live in that water. And I didn't want to drink it, but I was so thirsty. But if you're trying to wait for those young mosquitoes to go through between your hand, there's not much water left. So we drank it. We drank the whole thing.
And at this time, Mai, you had no idea what was going on with your children, I suppose.
At that time, we did not know where our children were, whether they were alive or dead. We met two American men. They gave us some bread and a gallon of water. And I can't remember to this date how precious and how sweet that bread and the water even tastes sweet to me. And we inquire about our children, and we gave them our address. And they told us there's nothing left if you live in that area. And I surely thought my children must die.
Nó rất là quý mà nó rất là ngọt. Đến khi cái tôi nói làm ơn chở tôi về để tôi coi thử con tôi nó còn sống hay không.
But we asked them to take us to our home, and they did.
Khi mà ông chở tôi về nhà tôi không còn nữa.
And like he said, there was nothing left on the ground, and I thought my children were gone.
Maite Van Pham and her husband Long didn't know what to do. It was a week before Maite got a phone call from her daughter Martha, and when she heard her daughter's voice, she told me she was afraid it was a call from the dead. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Before Hurricane Katrina, Maite Van Pham and her husband Long were shrimpers. They'd come to the U.S. from Vietnam as refugees. They worked hard, and soon they owned their own boat.
My husband really enjoyed working as a seaman, but for me as a woman, there were a lot of hard work, heavy stuff to be lifted. But I was just going along with my husband because the life of a shrimper provide what we needed, the money to pay for the children, education, the houses, the food. And so I was just going along. My husband truly enjoyed it, but for me it was kind of a hard work.
Did you feel that you and your husband were welcome there?
For the majority of the people that we met, they were very helpful. We did not feel a sense of anybody discriminate us or jealous with us.
Maite and her husband rowed out Katrina on the boat while their three children were on shore. But when the parents got back to Pas Christian, back to their home, there was nothing left. No kids, no house.
There was nothing left on the ground. The only thing left was the mailbox. And at that time, I remember wearing my shrimping shoes, and that was a very thick shoes. And I tried to search to see where my children are around that area. My husband pulled the shoes out, and it was full of blood inside the shoes because I have stepped on a nail and did not have any feeling, didn't know I stepped on the nail. Because my whole thoughts and feeling was about finding my children. I thought that they have flown away with the house out into the sea. And so all I was tremendously feeling sad and didn't want to live anymore.
Maite and her husband searched for 7 days. They'd found a place to stay, along with many other people. And it was late one night when Maite's cell phone rang.
I remember receiving that phone call about 1 a.m. in the morning. And when I received the call, I thought she must have called me from the dead. But no, she said she wasn't dead. And at that time, the house was full of people trying to avoid a storm, and everybody was sleeping. And I shouted her name, and that woke everybody up. Some people was very happy, some people was very mad because they were waking up by this shout. And I remember I said, I have the feeling that I wanted to exchange my life for my children's life.
What's your daughter's name?
Martha.
Martha, and that's the name you called out?
Yeah, yes. And she told me the story of a policeman came and kicked the door and took all the children into the car and drove them to the safe ground. And if he's listened, I'd like to find who that policeman is. Because of him, my children are alive today.
Did the children know where they were going?
The policeman told them that he was taking them to the high school to avoid the storm, so they know where they were going.
Mai, when you think about the house and everything that was taken from you, is there one thing that you miss?
The only thing that I missed was my children, and there wasn't anything else there that I was searching for or wanted to have. I just want my children back.
No family treasure that you'd brought all the way from Vietnam?
Không, chị không có tiếc cái đồ gì mà chị mang từ Việt Nam qua hay là không có cái gì quý giá hết à chị?
Không có, cô khi tôi đi tị nạn cộng sản.
All we could bring was our two hands when we escaped Vietnam. So there was no treasure there.
The Van Fams had nowhere to go. So they went back to that patch of land where their home had been.
Tôi kiếm mấy đứa con từ từ xeo tờ về đó, thì tôi về lại địa chỉ cũ nhà tôi.
We live right under the oak tree on our land. We got some of the nylon material that we have on the boat and just make up a tent and live under that oak tree. We saw a bus and it goes around and give food to the living. And so we got food from them. And then we couldn't go to shelter or school because those places were full. People was sleeping on the street. And there were people coming around and said that you cannot live here anymore because of the sanitation problem. There are dead bodies, and it's not good to stay. And my son and my younger son and my husband was coughing and was sick. And so we moved to our aunt in Birmingham. And then we had to go back to our place because my husband still had that boat and we want to see if we can fix it.
But the boat was a wreck. They'd estimated that they'd need $19,000 just to get it back in the water. The weeks turned into months. Two of Maiti's children moved away to join the military. Her husband was ill. There seemed no way out. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. That was about the time that Maiti met the North Carolina volunteer, Amy Hardy.
So we were living in trailer, and as I was walking, I remember around noontime, walking on the street of my neighborhood, I saw Miss Amy walking out from a building that said helping people to rebuild house. And so it's like a miracle that I met her. If I were just late or early 5 or 10 minutes, I probably never see her. And when I saw her, I told her about my story.
She walked up, and Vietnamese people had not traditionally come into the main fold of what we were doing. So when she kind of stood there shy over to the side, we were getting into the car, and we got out of the car and walked back over and said, "What can we do to help you?" And she just started crying and saying, "I have 3 children. No one will help me. I don't know what we're going to do. I have money. I have money." Magic words to us. Not enough money. But she said, "I need to put my family back together." And we couldn't understand what she was saying because she has broken English. So we just all stood there and cried and patted each other on the shoulder and said, "What are we going to do?" And we decided at that point we needed to make sure that she got a house.
Amy, did that have something to do with the fact that there wasn't a whole lot of communication between the Vietnamese people in New Orleans and people like yourself who were down there to help? That seems almost like there'd been an isolation of them because maybe they hadn't wanted to ask for help, or I don't know the reasons, but what was it that led you to say, hey, we have to do something for Mai?
Her pain. Her clear, desperate, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to, where to turn, and really seeing that there really didn't seem to be any place for her to turn. You just got to help that.
But this was a time when it was difficult for you to help everybody. You had to be very selective about who you were going to help.
That is true. But FEMA had guidelines that said that over 65, disabled, single family, and she met the criteria in the fact that her husband is very ill. This was a person that was at the end of her rope, and it just reaches out, and you just want to... She was just easy to know this is who we wanted to help.
Lúc đó hình như là tôi có một cái sức mạnh nào đó.
When I met Miss Amy, even though I do not speak much English at that time, but there was something that I felt inside that she was going to help me no matter what. I just put all my trust in her that she's going to help me. And that lift up some of the burden that I felt at the time.
Thì tôi đi về nhà để dọn.
My husband, he is a very proud man. He doesn't want to go and get any help from anybody. And everything about the house is in his name, and my name was not on it. So anytime I tried to go to any helping agency, I had to take his ID with his picture on it. And his pictures and seeing me, they wouldn't do anything because it's not the same person. And so I couldn't go anywhere to ask for help, and my husband wouldn't do it.
Miss Mai, you talk about your husband's pride, but I hear a lot of strength in your voice as well. Was it hard for you to ask for help?
Tôi đi khi mà tôi đi hỏi, tôi đi xin, tôi rất là mắc cỡ tại vì...
20 years living with my husband, I feel like I have been influenced by his pride as well. I feel ashamed in a way and shy at the same time. When I go and ask for help, I wouldn't know what to say to the people, how to ask for it. But there's something inside of me that gives me the strength to ask because I think about my family, my children, when they can return and how, as a family, we can rebuild our life so that our children can be at home with us and have a future.
Tôi cũng không còn luôn.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to the story of how one Vietnamese family got a home in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And they moved into it just last year, 2 years after the hurricane. Amy Hardy has been working with the Van Fams. She recalls that there were many forms to fill out and a lot of money had to be raised.
Every group that came down, we shared her story with them, that he was sick, her children were away, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And there was a town in Michigan that adopted them and gave them $11,000 toward their house. She did have some money. She put that in it. Tennessee Baptist put money in it. North Carolina Baptist put money in it. Mississippi Baptist. Oh, yeah, I worked a lot with the Baptist groups.
I got that.
I got that. But we found the money for the material, and it was not fast. It was not a quick turnaround, but we just kept our nose to the grindstone and kept working because we had an ultimate goal, and that was to get them back in their house.
And what's it look like now, Amy? What's the house look like?
Oh, it's gorgeous. She picked green for the color. It's kind of a shotgun house with 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms, a small kitchen. It has a covered porch. It's 9 feet off the ground, as is the FEMA. You have to have them 16 feet off the sea level. So you were able to use that space underneath, kind of like a patio. It's just nice. It's very nice.
Mai, do you remember the day that you moved in?
It did not seem real to me. I thought I was dreaming because I would never think that I could have a house again. And so it was like a dream to me.
What's your favorite part of the house now? Where do you spend most of your time?
Trong nhà của chị có cái chỗ nào mà chị thích nhất, mà chị ở đó nhiều nhất hay xài nhiều nhất trong nhà đó không?
Chỗ nào tôi thấy tôi cũng thích hết cô. Tại vì bây giờ mình có cái nhà rồi thì rất là mừng, nhưng mà...
I like every part of the house. Because I never thought I could have a house again. I remember bringing the paper to my husband after talking with Miss Amy about the possibility that somebody's out there can help us build a house with a little bit of our money. And he would look at me and he said, "Why do you dream during the daytime? There's nothing free in America. We work as hard as we had been, and we barely had enough to pay taxes on time. So stop dreaming about free houses." And when they put down the foundation for the house, Miss Amy would ask my husband, "Now, do you believe that you can have a house?" And he would say, "Yes." That's the time that when he actually think that we can actually have a house, somebody out there can help us build a house, when he saw the foundation, but not prior to that.
What did he say on the day that you moved in?
Khi mà ngày mà chị dọn vô nhà đó, chồng chị có nói gì với chị không?
Ông chồng tôi, ông nói là
he told me that
lần đầu
when
tiên
he left Vietnam,
ông rời bỏ Việt Nam,
the first time
tị nạn cộng sản
ấy, as a refugee, America rescued him and helped him. That was the first time. This is the second time that America has rescued his families again. He used to tell me that he liked to go back to Vietnam to live out his old age and die and be buried there. That's he's considered his homeland. But now he doesn't say that anymore. He said he want to live and work and be buried in America.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Mai Thi and her family remain in a very difficult situation. They make their living as shrimpers, but their boat was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina, and they don't have enough money to fix it. But it's not just the boat that's keeping her husband from working. As she told me earlier, he's quite ill.
He told me that he wanted to go back to work. He wanted to rebuild the boat. And the one thing that he really wished to do is to go back to work to earn some income so that he will pay taxes and contribute to the America for all that American has given us. I think my husband, if he can go back, become a shrimper, he would be well again because he loved to do what he had done in the past. And I truly believe that he would be well again if he can do that again.
Mai, how much money do you need to fix the boat? Can't you get a loan from the bank?
We have applied to the bank, both the local and the federal, but they both denied our application. They said that the boat was too badly damaged, and so they would not finance us. My husband, he never go to apply for any of these loans. He just asked to borrow from relative if he can, but he would not go and apply.
Mai, what's it been like for you these last 2.5 years?
Trong 2.5 năm vừa qua này thì cuộc sống tôi mệt lắm rồi.
Two of my children left to join the army. They did not want to come back because they saw death and the destructions. They often called though. But my youngest one, he does not want to talk. He just say one sentence here and there. He become a very quiet child. He sometimes blame us and said that why did we leave him alone during the storm? That we didn't take care of him. And for my husband, he doesn't want to do anything else. And for me, I feel very tired.
Chưa có một ngày nào cho bản thân tôi hết. Nên là bây giờ, nếu mà tôi chỉ còn có đủ sức hép ông ấy một chút xíu nữa thôi là coi như công việc của tôi làm vợ và làm mẹ đã xong rồi đó. Tại vì tôi mệt lắm rồi.
Trying to do what I do as a wife to take care of my family and my children. But I feel very tired. I feel like I have done everything I could have.
Why stay there, Mai? Why did you want to stay in the New Orleans area?
Tôi ở vùng đó là tại vì không trước.
I stay there because of my husband. He just wants to be a shrimper again. And as long as I married to him, I will stay there as long as he stay there.
In just a moment, I'll ask the two women, Amy Hardy, the aid worker, and Maite Van Pham, what it is they've learned from one another in the 2 years since they met. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina is still a major issue for this country. It's being reported today that in New Orleans alone, there are still 12,000 people without a home. I'm talking with two guests today. Maite Van Pham is a woman who moved to the U.S. as a refugee from Vietnam. She settled in the small Mississippi port of Pas Christian, and she also lost her home to Katrina. My other guest, Amy Hardy, went there as a volunteer, and she is still there, still helping people like Maite get settled. Well, Maite recently moved into her home, courtesy of the fundraising and the labor contributed by volunteers. And since that time, Maite has led other Vietnamese families to look for the help that's being offered. These two women, Maite Van Pham and Amy Hardy, say they have learned a lot from one another.
Mai is a good friend. It might sound like I had a lot to give her, but she has equally given back. What she can do, she does do. She is now our translator for those other families. She comes in and helps us walk them through what they have to do. It's a very willing spirit that she has received and she wants to give. The friendship alone is worth the journey. I think she confirmed faith. She knew somebody was going to help her. I think she confirmed persistence, because I can remember when we got in the car that first day, I said, how are we going to do this? And because the desire was there and the faith that was there, that there is a greater being that is moving us through things, you just wanted it to come together so truly that it really took everything you had and just made it the best it could be to get her into a house.
And Mai, what's the latest in your life? How's your husband?
My husband just came home from the hospital yesterday. He's very sick. I haven't received the bill from the hospital yet, but I told the hospital that I would pay. I could pay about $50 a month when shrimping season comes. I can find some work. And I could pay that much.
Do you think it'll be okay if your husband doesn't get back on that shrimp boat?
Chị nghĩ như thế nào nếu mà chồng chị không có trở lại cái con tàu cũ và để đi làm cái nghề cũ nữa?
Nếu mà ông không trở lại làm nghề biển nữa thì tôi nghĩ rằng chắc ông ấy chết.
I think he would die.
I want to also ask you about your children. You have two in the military. Have they seen the new house?
Hai người con của chị mà đi lính, they have came home about 4 times. One for the Mother's Day, one for the Father's Day, and one for the Vietnamese New Year to light some firework and on July 4th.
And what do they think of it?
Oh, nó mừng lắm cô. Nó rất là mừng. Nó nói là
they are very happy about the house. My children that's in the army, I think part of the reason why they became soldiers because they saw those soldiers that came after the storm to help clear the trees, rebuild the city, and that became their inspiration to do it. And I think my children have his father inspirations that wanting to help, wanting to be independent.
Chồng nó đi lính, chứ không nó không có đi lính.
You've given your children the home that you didn't think that they would have. You've given your husband a place that he now calls home. You should be very proud of yourself.
Tôi không nghĩ là như vậy cô, tại vì
I do not feel proud of what I have done. I believe all the things that we have now is possible because Americans people have big heart. They may not be rich in money, but they have a very big heart, and that make everything possible for my family.
So are you going to be okay?
Không biết đâu cô ơi, tại vì tôi có nói với cô là bây giờ đối với gia đình thì tôi mệt lắm rồi, tôi làm đủ bổn phận.
I don't know.
Thì tôi không biết tôi có okay.
I feel
không?
Like I have fulfilled my obligations to my family, but I feel very sad, very tired. And so I don't know what the future holds. And I like to thank all the Americans for rescuing my family twice. I don't know when I can repay all of that. I just pray that God somehow will repay them on my behalf.
Thanks a lot, Mighty.
Cảm ơn chị.
Cảm ơn. Thank you, sir. Cảm ơn cô như cô
yeah,
Hương.
Yeah, cảm ơn chị.
Mighty Van Pham and Amy Hardy live in Pas Christian, Mississippi. Special thanks today to our interpreter, Dr. Tu Trinh, and thanks also to Mai Nguyen, who assisted with the interview, and to one of our listeners, David Remington, who suggested the story in the first place. We get some of our best suggestions from you, our listeners. If you have one, you can just go to our website at thestory.org and send me a couple of lines. That's how it starts. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. We've had an interesting series of tales here about people's biggest mistakes at work, buildings that have been badly damaged, prototypes burned out. In fact, it's those stories that inspired George Glastris to write in. George was a history major from St. Louis who had always had a thing for collecting old stuff, some of which turned out to be valuable.
I used to bring things home, and my mother would roll her eyes and say, "What are you going to do with it? Don't waste your money." And then when I would sell something for $100 more than I paid for it, she would say, "You know, I always encouraged you to collect."
I love that kind of support.
Oh, yeah.
After college, George was in England looking for work. He knew he wanted something to do with collecting. He thought maybe he might work at a museum. He had to get some paperwork that would allow him to earn money in England. But when that came through, he got his first job offer, a job at an auction house. And when his first day of work arrived, he was pretty excited.
You know, I was going behind the green door. I was going into the back where nobody got to go.
So tell me what happened when you got behind that green door.
Well, I got introduced to the gentleman whose position I was taking, Hugo Marsh, and he basically was showing me all the different things we see. You don't want to take these, and these don't make any money. Kodak Brownie cameras, for instance. You're going to be getting calls all day long about them. They're worth $10. They're not worth anything.
Right.
And he says, "Oh, you'll see a few of these now and then." And he picked up this small wooden box. And he put it on the desk, pulled off the lid, and there was a tiny little Edison cylinder phonograph. And it was the GEM model, G-E-M, as in tiny. And he put the horn on it, and he put the wax cylinder on, and he played it. And I'd never seen one before. I'd seen the 78 playing Victrolas, but I'd never seen the cylinder player. I just said, "That is the coolest thing I've ever seen." And he goes, "Well, if you like this, wait till you see this." And he said, "Come here, help me move this." And we got on the floor and pulled this crude wooden trunk out from under a shelf. He lifted the lid and he said, "Here, help me with this." And we pulled out with these cloth straps a huge version of the same thing, a big cylinder phonograph.
These cloth straps. Now, are you saying that there were two of you standing on either side of the trunk and each lifting, you know, one side of this phonograph with the cloth straps?
Exactly. If you imagine how they put a coffin into the ground, They lower it down with these straps and then pull the straps out when they're finished. I mean, it's not so big that one person couldn't reach it.
Right.
It's, you know, maybe 3 feet long.
So Hugo showing you this other phonograph, and he's made the point that it's much better, much more valuable. What's he saying?
Well, that's what he said. He goes, this is a much rarer machine. It's really valuable. I've never had one before in one of my auctions. And he's explained to me what's important about it. It's from the 1890s. They were hired out by the Edison Company so people could do exhibitions of the phonograph at fairs and exhibits, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the phonograph didn't become a household item really until around 1900, give or take a couple years. And this was probably made 1893. So we lifted it up and put it on the floor. And he's explaining it to me, saying, you know, this is what it is. And one of our colleagues found it in somebody's barn out in the country. And, you know, I've put a pretty low estimate on it, but it should do more because they had one at Christie's last year, talking it up.
What was it worth?
I think at the time he put an estimate of £600 to £800 on it, saying it's going to make more than that. So we're looking at it, and his phone rings. And he says, you know, have a look at it and put it away when you're finished. I'm going to take this call. And he's on the phone talking to a client. So I go to pick up the machine with the straps that are around it. Now, I didn't realize that the electric motor is half the weight of the whole thing, and this thing probably weighs 65 pounds, and the motor is to the side. It's not in the center of it. The weight is all on the left side. And I grab the straps, pick it up. I didn't realize that these cloth straps were sewn together at one end. And the thread just came undone at the bottom. And the machine just crashed down on the left side with a huge bang and a splitting of wood.
How far did it fall?
Probably from knee high, you know, a foot. But 65 pounds of dead cast iron and 100-year-old mahogany.
And you're thinking what at this point, George?
My career just went down the toilet.
As you can imagine, George's new colleague, Hugo, noticed what had happened.
Now, Hugo, bless his heart, is your typical Englishman, calm, cool, collected. He watches this happen while talking to some little old lady and just closes his eyes and puts his face in his hands without skipping a beat.
He doesn't say anything.
No, he continues his conversation, which probably went something... Oh, yes, ma'am, they are very nice. No, I'm afraid they're not rare. Yes, my grandmother had one just like it, too. Trying to get this woman off the telephone with something that's worth $5.
And you're standing there holding a cloth strap.
Basically thinking, I'm going to be grabbed by the collar and thrown out the door any minute now. He puts the phone down and just so English says, oh, that looks like a bit of bother.
Which wasn't, I don't suppose, a whole lot of comfort for you because you're still thinking you're finished on your first day.
Yeah, I could just, you know, it's like the old Hollywood producer, you'll never work in this business, kid, you know. Oh, and they had hired me on probation. We'll give you a try for a couple of weeks and see how you do.
That was nice while it lasted.
Yeah.
What happened?
It wasn't as bad as we thought. The corner of the case, the wooden surround that held the machine in it, had broken at the corner on the joints, dovetails.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being really smashed up, it had opened up, and the dovetails came undone. So it's like if you put your hands together, finger on top of finger, just take your hands apart, but you still have the fingers.
So you can glue this back together.
Yeah, maybe a few splinters of wood had popped out and we picked them up. Well, he, of course, went to get the boss. Not in a, you're in trouble, but I better show our boss this.
Right. This is a little bit above my pay grade, right?
Exactly.
Can I ask you something, George?
Sure.
Were you feeling a little bit like the American who probably should never have been hired by the British auction house at this time?
Oh, totally. I'm from suburban St. Louis. We don't got no Monets in Baldwin.
What happens when the boss comes back?
Well, he's a very proper English gentleman in the pinstripe suit. And he just says, well, accidents happen, what? Hugo, do you think you can put it back together? And they were very good. They pretty much said, don't worry about it. Everybody breaks something. It's not the end of the world. I'm sure we can fix it. I hadn't put my foot through a Picasso. How's that?
But were you still wondering if you'd have a job there in 2 weeks?
I thought they would have to take that into consideration. But we were able to put it back together. And Hugo even said, look, it's my fault. I shouldn't have let you use those straps. I should have pointed it out to you. So in a way, he kind of took the blame.
And what happened to the phonograph? Did it ever sell?
Oh, yeah. It made 3,000 pounds. And bearing in mind that was 1989, today that machine's worth $10,000 to $15,000.
Did you develop a like or a dislike for phonographs after this event?
I developed a big like. I collect them myself now.
You have some now?
I have 25 or 30 of them.
Ever dropped one?
No. Not like that.
I wonder, George, if Hugo and his boss knew that, that having made that horrible mistake in your first hour or whatever on the job, that you'd probably be a blue ribbon employee after that. You'd never drop anything again.
May have been like a baptism of fire, but a little bit hotter than they expected. It has happened to everybody in the business. Anybody who tells you, I've never broken anything, is either a liar or asking for trouble.
And you went on to some considerable time in the business.
I'm still in it. I own my own auction company now.
Have any of your employees ever dropped anything?
I had one member of staff spill a cup of coffee on a 19th century print of an early railroad locomotive and not tell me until the auction was started. And I'm the auctioneer at this point. I announced the next lot is print of Boston and Maine Railroad Locomotive Number 10. And I just heard, coffee stain from the back.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. George didn't fire that employee. He knows he might still make the same mistake.
I'm a klutz to begin with. I bump into things. I've got poor depth perception to such an extent that when I was a teenager, my eye surgeon realized I had driven myself to my appointment, and he just said, they let you drive. I knock over coffee cups because I reach for it and I think it's farther away than it is, and I bang into it. I walk into doors.
So have you learned to separate the klutzy side of George from the curator auction side?
Every day is a struggle. Every day I have to be more careful. And luckily I work with instruments that aren't that breakable. You know, they could never let me work in the ceramics department. I would be the bull in the china shop.
Ancient stone carvings, maybe, right? You can drop those.
My luck, I could probably break the Great Pyramids.
George Glastris is an auction specialist in Chicago. Here's one of George's favorite songs. It's a wax cylinder, and he plays it on his phonograph. It's called Johnson Jazz Blues by the Frisco Jazz Band. This goes back to a time before the word jazz was standardized. If you are also the author of a colossal boo-boo at the workplace, I'd like to hear from you. You can go to our website and send me your story there. You can find us at thestory.org. Any suggestions for stories are welcome there. In fact, we get some of our best ones directly from you. It's all at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.